Wednesday, November 10th, 2010, ethics, and a couple of announcements. First of all, there'll be a workshop for deciding your grading options if you're thinking about taking a class, pass, no pass, or dropping, what implications do they have for your financial aid, and transferring. If you want to know all that stuff, they have some workshops arranged. And I sent out a email and not an email, I sent out a Moodle announcement in the announcement sections, which should go to your email if you have that enabled. If not, you should go to the announcement section and read it in Moodle.
Don't forget to take the exam. Second midterm exam is open through Monday, 7 p.m.
So Kant is a German writer. German writers are tend to use jargon and tend to be a little difficult to read, even in the English translations. Kant is probably one of the easiest to read German writers, so thank me that I'm not a little cowling who loves Heidegger, and I'm not making you read some of these other German writers like Hegel, which are even more difficult to understand. I think, though, with Kant, once you get past his style, he makes sometimes some profound points, sometimes some interesting points. And once you can get past his obtuse style, there's something really worth getting at there, both in his ethics and his metaphysics. He is the father of what's known as deontology. Deontology and utilitarianism are the two main contenders, I think, for ethical theories, of the realist ethical theories. Utilitarianism being the other one. Somebody want to dim the lights up here in front for me?
The screens are always blocked out.
Kant's kind of sort of a dour character, kind of a gloomy guest,
father of deontology. A lot of people regard him as being having a killjoy personality. He spent a lot of time alone in his study writing. He's much different from Mill, who is more gregarious and social and affable. So there it is, date 1724 to 1804. One of the most influential what are called modern philosophers. So philosophy, generally speaking, you have ancient, medieval, and modern. Modern philosophy starts out with Descartes in the 16th century. So Kant's considered to be a modern philosopher, even though he died in 1804. 20th century philosophy is usually called contemporary philosophy or something like that. Deontology says that the right act is that which is in accordance with the correct moral rule or principle. And so the deon in deontology is just the Greek word for rule. So it's the rule of philosophy. It says for every moral action, for every particular act, there is an appropriate moral rule or principle which either justifies the act as being right or shows that it is wrong. And you can have things which you have to do, which are obligations. You can have things you're forbidden from doing, which are forbidden or prohibited. And then you have things where you can either do them or not do them. And those are optional. They're permissible. So and for, you know, here's an interesting thing for Kant. These pins are all probably dead. Let's see what happens. And this fits in with our intuitions. There's the obligatory, the forbidden, and then the permissible. And so the forbidden or prohibited.
Prohibited.
So you think about the prohibited or forbidden, you know, the thou shalt nots, right? Like,
no murder.
Obligatory, what's something that you would have to do to be a moral person? Is there anything that you would like to, if you didn't do it, something that is a moral requirement, such so that if you didn't do it, you would be blameworthy? What about like helping somebody in need when it doesn't cost you anything? I think of an example. So someone is someone comes, it's like crawling on the street going, water, water, and they're like crawling down the street and you're right there next to a bucket of water, and all you have to do is just sort of elbow it over and it'll land on the person, they'll get a little water. Or you're holding like a water bottle, and you can just, or maybe there's like an empty water bottle like 10 inches from that person, but they collapse. And all you have to do is like just kind of scoot it over with your toe or something. And most people would think if you didn't do that, you'd be a pretty bad person. So the obligatory is what you must do. Helping those in need. The prohibited are the things that you can't do. Can't do it. And what can't you do? You're murdering some people. And then the permissible are things that it's morally okay to do, but you don't have to do them. What would the example of that be? Actually, Kant would put that in the first category. I mean, what here Kant would say the following. He'd say, any particular person, you may not be obligated to donate to them. But you have to donate to somebody. You might disagree. But he would say that if you don't donate anything to people in need, you're kind of a selfish bastard. According to Kant. What's an example of something which isn't morally wrong, but isn't a moral obligation or something that is required of you to do to be a moral person? Surely something falls in that category. It's not an obligation, it's not a prohibition or something which is forbidden. It's something which is just optional. You could do it, and it's not something you have to do. It's not something you can't do. It's just something you could do or not do.
Maybe.
How about something more mundane?
Just drive to the store and get a snack.
There you go. Go to the store and get a snack, right? Does going to the store and having a snack, is that a moral obligation? No, right? You can do that. You're not a bad person if you do it. Is it something which is prohibited? No, not yet anyway.
until snacks are outlawed. Michelle Obama seems to want to do that. So you get, it depends on this. If you count celery, maybe that would be okay. So it's one of these things which is neither forbidden nor prohibited. It's just it's neither forbidden nor required. It's just something you do, have no moral connotations. Now, what would utilitarianism say about this scheme? This is kind of common sense, right? You think about, most people think about, here are the things I have to do, here are the things I can't do, and here are the things that are just sort of morally neutral. Right? And you can think about these things as being morally neutral.
Or amoral. Right?
A person could be amoral. I'm not sure an action could be amoral.
Amoral
kind of sounds like there's some moral quality that you're ignoring. If you talk about a person as amoral, this person doesn't get morality or something.
Mm-hmm.
But these are just, they're morally neutral. They're not, they don't have any moral value at all. Well, for utilitarianism, your duty is to maximize happiness. How often do you have to do that? Every single minute of your life. You're supposed to be maximizing happiness. So then, any action which falls below maximal happiness is forbidden. Maximizing happiness, whatever the action has to be, at every moment is required, and there isn't any of this permissible stuff. So this one criticism of utilitarianism is it wants to lump everything into either the obligatory or the forbidden. There's no options to do. You don't have the option to do something that doesn't maximize happiness. Because if you do something that's going to make you, that's going to produce a lot of happiness, but not the most amount of happiness possible, you've done something wrong. Your obligation is to produce the most happiness, not just some happiness. So maybe something, one way in which Kant is maybe a little more common sense. So Kant defines the right act as that which is in accordance with the right rule or principle. So Kant rejects hedonism. He says that pleasure is not the only thing of intrinsic value. In fact, Kant questions the whole idea that pleasure is an intrinsic value. He also rejects consequentialism. And remember, hedonism says pleasure is the only thing of intrinsic value, and Kant says not only is it not the only intrinsic value, it's not even intrinsically valuable itself. And then he also rejects consequentialism, which is the idea that only the consequences of an action or the results of an action are morally relevant to its moral evaluation. So if you're thinking about whether something was right or wrong, Kant says the consequences are morally irrelevant. What you should look at is what kind of act is it? Is it an act of murder? Is it an act of torture? Is it an act of dishonesty? Then it's wrong, whatever the consequences. Is it an act of charity? Is it an act of honor? Well, then it's right, no matter what the consequences are. And remember, hedonism and consequentialism just together produce, utilitarianism. So Kant's view is the polar opposite of utilitarianism. Kant also is different from rule utilitarianism. So it's important to understand that Kant isn't saying if everybody followed the rules, it would maximize happiness. That's not your goal, according to Kant. And really, according to Kant, morality doesn't necessarily have a goal. If doing the right thing produces good consequences, that's just a side benefit. But the morality of an act is in the act itself, and the principle it represents, it does not depend on the consequences.
I'm kind of unclear. It seems like Kant said that the will behind the act is the morality of which was the right thing to do, not even the act itself. So, for example, if you thought the act, whatever you're thinking of the goal of the act in the beginning of the process, that's what defines morality, not even the process itself. Recent example, for example, if you decide to donate money just to get your name on the paper,
right.
Even though the act is donating money, mm-hmm. It's wrong because the intent behind it would be to get your name in. Right. So according to Kant, it seems like so.
Sure. I mean, that's a good point. That Kant says that motive is everything, and so. So the type, but he wants to say that the type, he would break down acts of charity done in order to get praise, and acts of charity done for their own sake or something. So Kant doesn't want to separate out the motive from the act. He kind of thinks about it as a package. And so it's. But what I want to say, and talk about the consequences, Kant wants to say that even if you perform an act of charity, and it has really good consequences, that wasn't necessarily a good act. Because whether it was a good act or not depends on what motivated. So it's a good point. But Kant wants to say that if you look at... Evan.
Does that make... let's say, bring in ethical egoism. Does that make doing something for your self-interest wrong to Kant? Does Kant see?
Not always. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing something with a kind of dishonest or ulterior motive, I would think you would say that. Yeah.
What if your intent is neither moral nor immoral, but you're committing a moral action? You know, like if you are doing the things that we characterize as moralist society, but your intent is in fact in, so you do that a habit or whatever. I mean, is that to him obviously doesn't adhere to what he believes, the standards of morality are. It doesn't make you a moral person. Does that make you immoral? You're not doing it for the wrong reasons. You're not doing it for the right reasons. You're just doing it.
Like to alleviate boredom, making poems for charity or something.
Or like you gave the example in the book, the guy who the shopkeeper,
right,
who just doesn't cheat his customers because he just doesn't, he's a nice guy, doesn't even think about it, it's just something he does. I mean, Kant doesn't think that he's moral, but is he immoral for not?
He's not necessarily immoral. If he does the correct act, but for the wrong reason, as long as it's not a reason which is morally bad, he's not a bad person.
But he's
not a good person, yeah.
So it's like moral permissibles.
Yeah, well, I think Kant would say he should have a certain motive for doing things. And so he doesn't get any moral credit, but he's not actually doing something wrong either, so he's not morally blameworthy for not having the appropriate motive.
So what difference does it make whether you get Kant's brownie points or not? I mean, you're still doing the right thing.
But you're not, I think Kant would say it's beneficial, but it's not moral. Because morality has to do with intent, and it has to do with people. And so, but I think there is this ambiguity, and maybe we should get to the basics of Kant. Because he does say that motive is everything, but then the question is, what if you have a good motive for performing a bad action? Like, and you get the idea of the conscientious Nazi. What if a Nazi really believes he's doing the right thing? Does that count as a good motive? And then if he's doing something with bad consequences, but he has a good motive, it seems like Kant would say he was good. But Kant rejects the idea that you would do a bad act, something which was immoral, based on a sincere motive. Kant thinks it's impossible to be sincerely wrong about the correct moral principle. But we'll get to that later. But I wanted to draw this contrast between Kant and rule utilitarianism, where rule utilitarianism says follow the rules which produce the most happiness. Kant says follow the rules which are derived from reason, which have nothing to do with happiness or the consequences of actions. There we go. So what is intrinsically good according to Kant? Kant says the only thing which is intrinsically good is a good will. And what does he mean by a good will? A good will acts independently of the consequences. So when you're acting with a good will, you're not thinking what will be the results of this action. You're not trying to you're not going through Bentham's hedonic calculus. You're trying to figure out what is the correct moral rule or principle. And so, So a good will, Kant says, is one which operates independently of the consequences.
if he only thinks the only thing he thinks is intrinsically valuable is a goodwill, then wouldn't he be a hedonist? He only thinks one thing is valuable.
No, because hedonism says pleasure is intrinsically valuable.
Oh, okay.
So he would say that pleasure is not. Kant makes this argument that pleasure is not intrinsically valuable because if you act with a bad will and obtain pleasure in the process, Kant says it's actually worse. In other words, if a bad person derives happiness from their bad actions, then we think that's a bad thing. If Saddam Hussein dresses a guy up in a Superman costume and throws him off the roof of a building to see if he can fly and gets a bunch of yucks off of that as he's pounding back scotch with his mistress in one of his palaces, we think that's terrible that he feels good about doing something bad to someone else. Right? And you think it would be better if Saddam maybe felt guilty about it. That might be better. You don't want bad people to experience pleasure or happiness as a result of their bad actions. So, according to the utilitarian, though, it seems that even sadistic pleasure has some value. It's just outweighed by the pain of the victim. But in this way, I think Kant is more common sense. He says that sadistically derived pleasure is bad in itself. It's not just bad because it creates more pain than pleasure. It's bad in itself. So Kant considers other intrinsic goods. So again, happiness, you don't want bad people to be happy. Intelligence, how could intelligence be bad?
A jewel thief who can outsmart any other security systems.
Yeah, there you go. Again, a person with a bad will who's using their intelligence to steal things. Kant says it's bad. Most criminals are dumb. And the rational person will want all criminals to be dumb. Wit, sense of humor. How could that be bad? Well, what if you cause someone pain with your wicked sense of humor? I had a friend. He was in junior high school. And there was this guy at his junior high school named Russ. And Russ had this really bad skin problem. And it was, just as awful. Acne, and he had the worst case of acne he'd ever seen. And so my friend made up this little rhyme about Russ, which was extremely funny to, a bunch of 13 and 14-year-olds. And the rhyme was, Russ, pimple pus, pops his zits all over us. And they had like a chant, and every time Russ would go in the room, they go, Russ, pimple pus, pops his zits all over us. And Russ was kind of like, he has a skin problem, he's kind of because of this, he's already kind of an introvert, and he's like, whatever, and feels bad. And they'd like taunt this guy mercilessly. And it got to the point where everybody knew the rhyme, and they didn't have to say the words, they just go. And everybody knew what it meant. And he, to this day, says, I feel really bad about doing that. I was just a dumb kid. But, that's like, even though the people that did that got a lot of pleasure from making fun of this poor guy, you think, oh, that's mean, that's cruel, that's wrong. And even if the pleasure of the people making fun of Russ because of their number outweighed Russ's misery and happiness and the consequences in his life, you'd still think that's wrong. And so, because it was done with a bad will, because it's cruel and mean. Freedom. People can misuse, they can use their freedom to, a good example, this would be, but freedom can be bad if it's used with malevolent intent. And so Kant says, everywhere you look, all these supposed goods are only good if they're combined with a good will. And so he rejects everything else as being intrinsic goods. And he says only acting with a good will is intrinsically good. Yeah?
According to Kant, what does having a good will entail?
It means doing the right thing because it's the right thing.
Okay.
So, and that was, I think that was, for some reason...
How does he determine what's right? Is it...
Oh, we'll get to that in a minute. But Kant says that acting with a good will means acting out of respect for the moral law.
doing the right thing because it's right. Now, I think it was on my earlier slide that for some reason it's mysteriously not appearing. It belongs right there at the bottom, so I'm not sure what's going on here. Might be a mad PC thing or something. All right. So Kant says there's two types of motives for any action. You can act on desire, or you can act from reason. Acting from desire is when you want something and you're motivated to get it to bring yourself pleasure or happiness. Acting from reason, on the other hand, is when you're acting out of principle. You're acting out of respect for the moral law. So Kant goes into detail about this, and the shopkeeper, the example of the scrupulously honest shopkeeper, he actually gives three separate motivations. Two of them have to do with desire. So suppose you have a shopkeeper who is scrupulously honest. He never shortchanges customers. He always treats them fairly. He might have three possible motivations. One, Kant calls direct inclination, meaning he's a nice guy and he would never think about cheating his customers. He loves his customers. He wants what's best for his customers. He's a friendly, helpful, kind person. And so he just does this second nature, because and he does it for its own sake. He helps his customers for their own sake. And Kant says that's a desire. It's a feeling. You enjoy being an honest person. Kant says another possibility, also a form of desire, is that perhaps he doesn't want to treat his customers honestly, but he knows that if he doesn't, he's going to be in trouble. He's going to have trouble with the law. He's going to even possibly end up in jail. His business might close down because people find out that he's dishonest. So his view here is just that honesty is the best policy. So he does want to be honest, but it's a kind of an indirect thing, in that the only reason he wants to be honest is to avoid losing customers, to avoid being thrown in jail, or to avoid other bad consequences for him. And then Kant says there's a third possible motivation, though, which has nothing to do with desire, and that's acting from duty. And in there, he says to himself, it's wrong to cheat customers, therefore I will never do it. And regardless of what he desires, he says it's wrong to cheat people. And that's the reason he does it. And Kant says this is really the only form of motive which makes his action morally praiseworthy, which gives him moral credit. Because these other two motivations, this is just him doing what he wants to do. If he had wanted to cheat customers or thought he could get away with it, he'd do that. So Kant says that only acting from duty gives you moral credit. Doing the right thing because it's the right thing. Everybody got this? And myself. So what does duty mean? So three things. Acting out of respect for the moral law. Acting from principle is another way of putting it. Acting out of moral principle as opposed to for some personal gain. And doing something because it's the right thing to do, or not doing something because it's the wrong thing to do. And Kant says that doing having some other motives mixed in there is okay. So if you're the shopkeeper and you say, well, I would never cheat a customer because it's wrong, and you say, and you know, it's I kind of enjoy being honest, and you know, I'll never end up like that guy down the street who nobody goes to his shop because they think he's a cheat, and I'm getting all that guy's business, that's pretty good for me. You know, honesty really is the best policy. And I never have to worry about getting caught or going to jail. And so you might have all sorts of other reasons mixed in. As long as duty is your primary motive, and as long as that's the main reason you're doing it, having some other things mixed in is okay. And Kant thinks this is, it might be a good deal, because if you enjoy being honest, you're more likely to be honest. Now, what happens when duty and desire coincide, when you really enjoy doing your duty? Well, it's, you know, it's lucky you, right? It's good when desire and duty coincide. And he gives the example of the duty to preserve your life. So for most people, it's not difficult to fulfill the duty in context you do have a duty to preserve your life. So it's not a temptation to kill yourself. But then Kant says, well, what about... So for your average person, their duty and their desire coincide. But then you might get someone who's suicidal, right? And maybe he's up to his eyeballs in debt, and his wife just left him, and then maybe he gets thrown into prison, right? And so then for that guy, Kant would say that's a real temptation for him to kill himself. It would be wrong, but it's much more difficult for him to fulfill his duty to preserve his life. Maybe he finds out he has a terminal illness too, on top of it all, right? So that's a strong temptation, and he's going to have to muster a lot of willpower to fight against that. Whereas your average person walking down the street, nothing's necessarily bad, nothing's really good, but most people don't on a regular basis think about killing themselves. It's only when things get really, really bad that that becomes a temptation. And so Kant thinks that your desires... Yeah, it's kind of fortunate for you if your desires and your duty coincide. So if you had good parents that taught you to be honest, that's going to be beneficial. But it doesn't really have any effect on whether your action is moral or immoral. Except for Kant thinks that maybe you even the person who perseveres in the face of temptation, that person might even deserve more moral credit because they have to work harder to do the right thing. So... the guy who could take the easy way out and kill himself, Kant might say, deserves more credit than your average Joe walking down the street who just doesn't have problems of that same sort. So having good desires itself, though, Kant says, is not praiseworthy. If you're a naturally honest person, if you enjoy helping people, if you're full of love and compassion, Kant says, that's just feelings. Feelings don't matter. Feeling, you know, most people enjoy having good feelings, but he thinks that has nothing to do with morality. Morality has to do with your actions, and actions done from the proper intent, which doesn't mean acting out of love and compassion, it means acting out of respect for the moral law. And so Kant considers a philanthropist, a person who gives a lot of money away. And he says, suppose a philanthropist gives lots of money away to people in need, and he does that not out of principle, just because he enjoys giving money away. Kant says, that guy doesn't deserve any credit whatsoever for anything he's done. It's beneficial to the people who receive it, and they might be happy, but that's not a moral act, because he's just doing what he enjoys, right? If he had enjoyed, snorting a cocaine off a hooker's belly and buying big fancy yachts and jet setting around the world, he would have been doing that. It's just that for this guy, this is kind of his hobby, giving money away to people. He's not thinking about the larger principle, about his obligations to society or his obligations to help people in need. He's just doing it because he kind of gets off on giving money away. That's not a moral act. Another example, if you've read A Christmas Carol, there's a character named Mr. Fezziwig. So Mr. Fezziwig is kind of this jolly, kind of rotund, bald guy who runs a law firm. And not only does he treat his employees well, but he throws these big parties and he's always jovial and everybody loves him. And I think Kant would say that he might be a pleasant fellow to be around, but unless he's saying, I need to treat my employees fairly, unless he's conscious of the fact that he has certain obligations to his employees and he should treat them in certain ways, he's not really acting in a moral fashion. He's just being who he is. And he just happens to have this jovial character and he's kind of a giving person. But that doesn't mean he's a moral person. So some objections to Kant. I mean, one is that, going back to Scrooge, in Christmas Carol. So what do you think about this? So one, what would Kant say about Mother Teresa? If Mother Teresa is helping the poor and the sick in Calcutta because of her compassion and her love, the love in her heart, what would Kant say about her?
Since her motivations weren't necessarily duty, that her acts don't mean anything.
Yeah, from a moral point of view, they're kind of a wash. They don't have any value at all. Yeah.
Well, what if she felt a sense of duty because of her religion?
Yeah, so, and actually in interviews, she really focuses on love and compassion and feelings. And I haven't read everything she's written, but that really seems to have been her focus, of her feelings. Now, it might be that she has some other motive, and if it was her main motive, then that would be moral. Like if she's saying, I have an obligation to help the poor, it's my duty, that means she gets moral credit. If she says, oh, I love helping the poor, I look out on the huddled masses and I feel sorry for them and I feel I have to do something. That's just feelings, that's desire. Desire, and one way to think about Kant is that Kant's kind of he's a psychological egoist with regard to desire. Kant is a psychological egoist with regard to desire. So desire is selfish. Desire is essentially selfish. And this is why Kant's kind of down on pleasure and happiness and fulfilling desires, because he tends to think of it as being selfish and having nothing to do with morality, which is a matter of moral principles derived from reason. And so, although desire is selfish, acting from reason or principle is not. But when you're doing something immoral, you're not being moral because you want to be moral. You're doing something else. You're following your moral obligation, which comes from your reason. Yeah.
So our moral principles are derived from reason to Kant.
Mm-hmm.
So what if you derive unreasonable value or a value that isn't based on reason, but you value it and you still act on that principle and you have a goodwill towards that principle? Would he say you're a moral or immoral person?
Kant doesn't think it's possible to come up with bad moral principles if you're a rational person. And he tends to say two things. He says, if you come up with bad moral principles, you're either letting your desires overwhelm your reason, or you're irrational in some other way. So, like for example, you say, it's my moral obligation to blow up Israeli teenagers at the pizza parlor to further the Palestinian cause. And Kant would say, if you think it's okay to blow up innocent teenagers for a political purpose, either A, all your maybe seething resentment at the Israelis for the way you've been treated, or you've gotten carried away with your political ideology, but you're letting your desires for revenge or your bad feelings about Israelis or what have you, you're letting those overwhelm your reason, or you're just stark raving loony, you're crazy or something, right? You're the mad bomber. But you can't be a fully rational person and think it's okay to kill innocent people for a political purpose. Yeah.
So would that make irrational or insane people immoral to Kant?
Well,
or their actions immoral?
Yeah, I think Kant would. Well, you get into a difficult thing, because what if you're insane? Are you really responsible for your actions? Yeah, I'm not sure what he would say about that. But take like the conscientious Nazi again. He'd say the person is either sort of all caught up in this idea of the master race and being one of the chosen and, you know, being special. And so his desire is overwhelming his ability to comprehend objective moral principles.
or he's, you know, a crazy Nazi who, you know, loves killing people, and this is sort of his excuse or something. Yeah.
I guess I'm not quite understanding how a moral rule is the product of rational thought. I mean, it is. By what basis does he determine exactly what is moral, besides just saying whatever is the rational thing to do? Because, I mean, rational thought can lead to any number of outcomes. It just seems like, what is the basis for him determining what is morally just? For example, it may seem more rational to, you know, utilitarian who thinks the opposite of can't, to torture one person to save a million.
Mm-hmm.
That seems rational,
right.
Honestly. And that would seem like a moral principle to which I would be obligated to fulfill, you know, to torture that person to save a million. The con would be immoral and irrational. I would like to know why. That's
interesting. Well, hold that thought for a few minutes. So we haven't got to how Kant derives his rules of reason. So just sticking on Kant, on motivation. So Kant says that both Mother Teresa and Scrooge are motivated by desire. Scrooge before his conversion, right? When he's the greedy so-and-so that mistreats his poor Clark, Bob Cratchit, and is, you know, a miser and never helps anybody. So what's motivating Scrooge? Money. What does he care about? Money. So does he care about other people? No. What's his highest value? Business. So, but that's just like what Scrooge desires is money and business. And for business to go well, regardless of how he treats his employees. But Mother Teresa is any different except for what she desires. What does she desire? Helping people. Why? What does that result in? She helps people. Why? Because she wants to. So only the consequences, misspelled, are different. So again, Kant says morality doesn't have anything to do with the consequences. Morality has to do with observing the correct moral rule or principle. And so if you're acting out of desire, whether it's desires to help people or desires to harm people, it's still desire. And morality is exactly from principle. Morality is independent of the consequences. And I think that finally, that the reason Kant wants to separate out desire, which he characterized primarily as selfish or maybe entirely as selfish, from reason, is he really can't control what you desire. You know, you want what you want. You have the character that was formed as you develop. And some people have a more beneficent character, and other people have a more, you might say they have more malevolent desires. Or people have less regard for the welfare of others. And Kant really doesn't talk about like what makes one person, you know, sort of more giving and more beneficent and more honest and so on, whether it's genetics, environment, or both. But he thinks that you desire what you desire, and what you do have control over is your actions. So you can't control what your desires are, but you can choose to resist the desires to hurt people and to go along with the desires to help people. And really what you need to do is follow moral principle regardless of what you desire. You need to call your mother on her birthday, regardless of whether you want to or not. And now, if you want to call your mother, you know, that's good. If you get along, like I get along great with my mother. My wife doesn't get along with her mother that well. And so for me, calling my mother is a joy. And so for my wife, calling her mother is a chore, and even worse than a chore. I'm not sure what way to characterize it, but it's something which is a drudgery. But it's an equal obligation to each one of us. It's just that it's easier for me to do my duty because I find it pleasant than for her to do her duty because she finds it painful. Oh, you can't control what you choose. So you can't control your desires. You can control what you choose. And this goes back to Kant's saying that morality is a matter of having a good will. It means freely choosing to do the right thing because it's right, not because you desire it, or not in spite of the fact you desire it. It's not as if you, you know, get extra credit points for doing something unpleasant. Although actually in a few places Kant maybe does imply that, but it's that your choice, you need to do the right thing regardless of what your desires are. Yeah.
So that would make your wife more moral because it's more mature for her?
Yeah, maybe she gets more credit. Like, do you think...
Okay.
When Kant talks about what's morally praiseworthy, he talks about a person who's in bad circumstances and thinks about killing himself, but courageously struggles on despite the fact that he has cancer and his wife left him and he's in prison and he's in debt. All the bad things that could happen to him. Whereas the person who is, just won the lottery and married a supermodel and his life is nothing but sweetness and light and he has perfect health, that that guy, it's not a temptation to commit suicide. So maybe, I don't know if he'd say he doesn't get as much credit, but at least Kant wants to give credit to people who struggle against their desires. And he doesn't really want to blame people for having bad desires because he thinks that it's not really their fault. The desires result from the kind of sort of maybe genetics and environment plus the circumstances, things that happen to you that you also don't have much control over. Okay. I had this up here. So to act morally, you have to appreciate and act moral qualities. When you're going to do something, you have to think, okay, in this circumstance, what is the correct moral rule and principle? And how does it apply to this particular situation? And so, again, Kant is a psychological egoist with our desire. Moral action isn't motivated by desire. It's motivated by reason. Reason meaning, so morality is doing what you should do, what you ought to do, whether you want to do it or not. So it's doing what you should do or doing what you want to do. Doing what you should do, whether you want to do it or not. Doing what you ought to do, performing your moral duty, regardless of whether you want to or not. Questions or comments so far, other than the ones which are sort of in holding pattern. So Kant gives us we'll look at Kant's categorical imperative, where he tells us how to derive all the rules of morality. So Kant talks about imperatives. An imperative is a kind of command that we give ourselves. It's a general policy or principle of action. Oops. And a command that we give ourselves. So, some examples here. There's some here. So there's two kinds of imperatives. So again, imperative, it's in English, you have the imperative form you remember your English grammar, right? Usually with an exclamation point. Go away, I'm busy, right? That's the imperative command. You're telling somebody to do something. Don't, or it could be a negative one. You kids, get off my lawn, right? Or whatever it is, right? So you give and Kant thinks about an imperative as a kind of thing, kind of command that you give yourself. You say, here's my policy of action. Here's what I'm going to do in certain circumstances. So he says there's two kinds of imperatives. The first is a hypothetical imperative. A hypothetical imperative tells you how to achieve some desire you have. So, I'll have examples in the next page here. So the hypothetical imperative tells you how to achieve some desire. So you have a desire, you want to, you're tired, right? And so you want to perk up. So you say, in order to perk up, I'll drink this energy drink. And you're bouncing off the walls. Your Red Bull gives you wings or whatever. And so that's just a practical thing. The categorical imperative, and it fulfills some desire you have. You have a desire to pay attention. You have a desire not to feel so tired. You have a desire to wake up. And so you find something that fulfills that desire. The categorical imperative tells you what you have to do regardless of your desires. So it's categorical in that there aren't any exceptions. And so don't kill innocent people is a categorical imperative. It tells you what your obligation is, regardless of whether you really want to kill that guy who's been blasting stereo since 8:30 in the morning on a Saturday, which is your only day to sleep in. Or you think, I could, if I bumped off my wife and made it look like an accident, I could collect insurance money. Right? Even though you really, really want to do that, and you think you might even get away with it, you're still forbidden for doing that. Because the categorical imperative tells you it's wrong. So here's some examples. The hypothetical imperatives are practical guides completely unrelated to morality. And they always have the form, if you want X, do Y. If you want to lose weight, eat fewer calories and exercise more. The exercise thing, depends on how much you want to exercise. Anybody read about the guy who went on the Twinkie diet? Mm-hmm. It's a nutrition professor. He lost 27 pounds eating Twinkies and Oreos. And his idea was to prove calories in, calories out. So I think it was eating 1,800 calories a day, which actually is a fair amount of calories. But it was Twinkies, Oreos, maybe some candy bars, and then like in the morning he had a protein shake, and then he ate some celery in front of his kids or something to set a good example, and a can of green beans or something. So he would just eat a little bit of vegetable and roughage, a protein shake, and the rest of it was all junk food. And that's how he lost weight. So he just ate fewer calories. I would recommend that. It's like, doing that for a year could probably be bad for a couple of years. His good cholesterol went up and his bad cholesterol went down. But what if he was normal body weight already? Well, then this wouldn't apply to him. Right? So it only applies to you if you have the relevant desire. I'm trying to think of some beautiful actress. I used to pull up the Calista Flockhart from Ally McBeal. But if you're already bone thin, you don't want to lose weight, right? You're going to try up and blow away. Or if you're just getting normal body weight, it doesn't apply to you. If you want a safe yet profitable investment, select a diversified mutual fund. I need to update this PowerPoint. It should say buy gold. Gold is about $1,400. Mutual funds still down in dumps. Stay away from real estate unless you can buy a foreclosure. But you can see that. Now, what if you don't have any money to invest? What if you're a poor student living paycheck to paycheck or government grant to government grant? Well, this doesn't apply to you then. Right, so you can ignore it. If you want to improve your grades, spend more time studying. What if your grades are already good? Doesn't apply. So these are all hypothetical imperatives, and they're about how to achieve some desired end. And this is a lot of the sort of means-ends reasoning you find in utilitarianism, right? You try to figure out how do I maximize happiness. In this case, you're just thinking about, how do you fulfill your desires? Categorical imperatives are completely different concepts. A categorical imperative is an absolute guide to what you should do, which comprises morality. And so these take the form either do Y or don't do Y or do X. Don't kill innocent people. But what if I really want to kill innocent people? Doesn't matter. Don't cheat on your ethics test. I'm getting a low grade. I don't know if I'll pass the class. I think I can get away with it. Still wrong. I had a guy actually, he thought he was going to John Hopkins Law School until he plagiarized his paper and cheated on his final. And so he ended up not going to John Hopkins after all.
Sounds like you make a pretty good lawyer, though.
Yeah, well, exactly. So I think the reason why you would make a bad lawyer, though, is he got caught.
Yeah.
He was just an idiot, too. He had like a whole paragraph actually from Kant in his final. Like verbatim, when you're not allowed to carry any materials into, it's like a blue book exam. He's like, as it says in the Metaphysics of the Moral, thus a man who is in dire distress, it's like, oh, what an idiot.
help those in need. I don't like helping people. I want to do things for me. I am my priority. Doesn't matter. You have an obligation. Keep your promises. But, you know, what if you made a promise that's really painful? Best not to promise in the first place, right? But once you promise, you have to deliver common sense. So you have an obligation to keep your promises as painful as they may be. Okay, so now we're getting to the meat of the thing here. The categorical imperative is the principle which unites all the other individual categorical imperatives. This is Kant's principle of morality. And so he says it's the same principle of reason, which can be stated a number of different ways. We're just going to look at two. So the categorical imperative, the essence of morality, can be expressed as follows. And also, each of these ways of formulating it acts as a test. We're just going to look at two. I guess I have this in the next page. So he thinks that he actually gives four different ways it can be formulated. We're just going to look at the first two. And so each way of expressing morality or the categorical imperative acts as a test for any action to see whether it's moral or immoral. Okay, so you start out with a maxim or a principle of action. You want to test some general policy or principle of action to see whether it's right or wrong. And so Kant gives an example, or the first formula. The first formulation of the categorical imperative, abbreviated CI, so the is called the universal law formulation. And this is kind of long. Actually, I think I shortened this up. So the first formulation of the categorical imperative, the essence of morality, is act only on a maxim that you could will to be a universal law. Act only on a maxim, a principle of action, you could will to be a universal law. Now, how was that? Well, Kant reasons as follows. The one thing you know about morality, he says, is it's universal. Kant's a moral universalist or a moral absolutist. And so he says, it's not like each person has their own morality. There's one set of rules which applies to everyone. And that means that any principle of action you might have, in principle, has to be possible for everyone else to act on. So, one way of testing a moral principle is see whether it's possible for everyone else to act on it. So he gives the example of the false promise. Anybody remember this from the text? Give my voice a rest here for a minute. That anybody remember the example of the false promise or the lying promise, where the guy owes a bunch of money and he's trying to find a way to get out of it? Any takers? Okay, well, I'll give you the example and you see what we think about it. So Kant says, imagine a guy, he's in debt up to his eyeballs. He owes a bunch of money, and he's looking for a way to pay it off. So he can't get the money from anywhere, so he finally goes to his friend and he says, look, I need to borrow some money. Since you're my friend, please lend me the money so I can pay off my creditors, and then I'll gladly pay you off, and I'll pay you off as soon as I can. And he makes a promise to pay his friend off as soon as he gets the money. He borrows the money knowing there's no way in hell he's ever going to be able to pay his friend back. But he does it because his creditor is going to have him thrown into debtor's prison or some other bad consequence. His friend's not going to do that to him. So he takes advantage of his gullible friend, of his good-natured friend, gets the money, pays off his creditors. And Kant says, well, okay, was that a moral act? And Kant says the way you test that is you'd see if you can imagine a world where everyone lied to get money to pay off their debts. So could you imagine a world like that, where everyone lied in order to get money to pay off their debts? Could you imagine a world where everyone acted that way, on that, had that principle, as the same principle as the guy who borrows the money under false pretenses? What do you think?
what would a world be like where everyone would borrow money under false pretenses from my gullible friends? Yeah.
Nobody would loan money.
There you go. Maybe that's the real world. That's the world right now. Nobody's loaning money now. But yeah, that's the idea that in a world of liars and cheats, nobody would take anybody's word for to lend money. And Kant says in such a place, the people, it would be like a joke. You could say, hey, can I borrow $5? I'll pay you back tomorrow. And you rib your friend, and he'd laugh, and he'd laugh, and he'd say, okay, what are you going to put up for collateral? Oh, here, hold on to my cell phone for a day or something. Right? So everything would have to be collateralized. And so he said it would be like borrowing money without collateral would be a joke. Nobody would do it anymore. So. So his point is that if you couldn't imagine a world where everyone did that, that shows you that it's not universalizable, therefore it's not a moral action. Because we know morality is universal. And so this is what Kant says is a contradiction in concept, and it shows that it's immoral. So Kant says you can't imagine a world where everyone acts on this maxim or principle. Therefore, it's a contradiction in concept. Because you want to be able to borrow the money to pay off your debts by lying to your friend, but if everyone lied in order to get money out of friends, their friends would never lend them money. And in which case, you would live in a world where you wouldn't be able to get what you need. And so Kant says that's a contradiction. It's a contradiction in concept, and therefore Kant says the maxim destroys itself, and it shows you that that's not a moral principle. Or that's an immoral maxim that you can't act on. People are looking skeptical. Now, before criticism, I want to make sure people understand what's going on here. So Kant says, morality is universal, therefore it's going to be the same for everyone. Assume that is your premises. Okay, now, therefore, any action you perform has to be possible for everyone else to do. Try to imagine a world where everyone does it. And you can see, sometimes you see this to little children, right? Well, Johnny, what if everybody fill in the blank, right? And you do that, and they're like, oh yeah, I guess I shouldn't do that. Right? That's sort of what Kant's saying. Yeah.
So you can then, Kant could argue against the Nazi who does a duty to the Third Reich out of duty and honor, and maybe achieves his positive outcome, even though he has good motive, by saying that if you imagine a world where that sort of will to exterminate people who didn't agree with your viewpoint were universalized, it wouldn't just be about the Nazis and the Jews. It could be any two people or any two groups of people thinking they could exterminate one another.
Right.
So
exterminate your enemies. Essentially, I had a question about how specific the maxims should be. Should it be, don't murder, when there's someone I don't agree with, I'll have them murdered, or is it when I have political enemies, I'll try to create concentration camps? Or, I mean, it's hard maybe to qualify how particular the maxim should be. And as we'll see later on, that's kind of turns out to be a possible criticism of Kant. But the basic idea is that if you can't imagine a world where everyone does it, it shows that it's forbidden, that it's wrong. And just a couple of examples might make it more clear here. Suicide. So, when I'm feeling depressed and I'll end it all by killing myself. And Kant says, well, what if everyone, when they felt dejected and depressed and their life wasn't worth living, killed themselves? Then what would happen?
The happy world.
There'd be no people. In which case, your parents would have given birth to you and you wouldn't be around today thinking about killing yourself. So again, he would say there's a contradiction in concept, because you're even being able to contemplate suicide relies on the fact that everybody in the world did commit suicide. Murder. So he thinks that if everyone went around murdering, then there'd be no people left. So you can't universalize the idea, I will commit murder to achieve my personal ends. Yeah.
Well, I can imagine a world with no people. I think you wouldn't have to prove that a world with people is better than a world without people. Because that's something I can't imagine, just because it isn't the reality I live in.
Right, maybe I should say, you try to imagine a world where everyone acted as you acted, and you're still able to do what you're doing. So it's a little, it's, Kant wants to say that you can't imagine a world where everyone acts on the maxim, including you. So in other words, you're thinking, well, what if everyone did it? If everyone did it, would I still be able to do it? So if everyone committed suicide, I wouldn't be able to commit suicide because I wouldn't be here. If everyone committed murder, I wouldn't be able to commit murder because I wouldn't be here. If everyone lied to get money, I wouldn't be able to lie to get money because nobody would lend me money because I live in a world of liars. So that's sort of where he's going. Theft is another good example. So there's a famous, Proudhon, one of the famous communist writers, said all property was theft. And if you think about it, if everyone stole all the time from everyone else, would there even be such a thing as property? It seems that this idea of property is parasitic on the notion of people respecting the property rights of other people. So in a world, so suppose you're thinking about stealing something that you want without earning it or trading for it or borrowing it. So you're going to steal it instead. Well, Kant says in a world of thieves, there wouldn't be any such thing as property, in which case you wouldn't be able to steal. And you could think about your property would kind of lose its meaning. Or you might imagine people would just be paranoid about like having their property stolen, so where they would be locked and nailed down and so on. So think about like you're thinking about stealing somebody's bicycle, right? Well, in a world where everyone stole everyone else's bicycle, what would the world like that be?
You
borrow. Oh, there you go. No, it might even be considered to be like borrowing, right? Would it really be stealing in a world like that? And then the thing is, would you be able to get that bicycle you're thinking about stealing? If everyone was constantly stealing bicycles, either it would be secure, or people really wouldn't care, and they would just like there'd be bicycles, you know, laying around in random places, and people would or maybe somebody else would have already stolen it. I'm not sure what the deal was, but his idea is that in a world of thieves, property would lose its meaning. Therefore, you wouldn't be able to steal that bicycle because maybe there wouldn't even be any bicycles, right? If you take this to an extreme, in a world of thieves, would you even have bicycle-making factories, right? People would steal the parts from the factories. They would try to put together their own bicycle home. So this goes back to Hobbes' idea of the state of nature, right? And it seems that rampant theft would create a world such that bicycles couldn't even be made. So all the above, these things, he says, contain, again, a contradiction in concept. You think you want to do this one thing, but if everyone did it, you wouldn't be able to do that thing. Also, these generate negative duties. So Kant says, if you can't imagine a world where everyone did it, you have a duty not to do that thing. Because you can't imagine a world where everyone murders, you have a duty not to murder. Because you can't imagine a world where everyone steals, you have a duty not to steal. Because you can't imagine a world where everyone lies and deceives, you have a duty not to lie and deceive. Yeah.
How does this apply to obligatories? Like, let's say, you know, there's a child drowning, you know. If you threw them a life support, if you rationalized it and like this, if everyone threw that child a life support, you wouldn't be able to.
Well, I think that's a particular action. Like everyone, you couldn't imagine everyone doing a particular action.
Okay. So if you save the child, if everyone saved the child, you couldn't save the child. So let's say there's like five people, and you go to save the child, and everyone goes to save the child.
That's one action. That's one.
But that's like a one specific okay. action, sort of a type of action.
Okay. A type of.
And actually, we're getting to the duty to help in a minute. So Kant thinks you also have duties to help. So another example, Kant has a rugged individualist. This is a person who says, "I'm not going to help anybody else, and I don't expect any help from them." And so Kant said, you could imagine a world where nobody helped anybody else unless they had something to gain from it. But he says no rational person would want to live in a world like that. So you could imagine a world where no one would help anyone else without a reward, but no rational person would want that world to exist. So Kant puts it this way, he says, you can't consistently will such a world to be. This is, he used the word will, and will to will something to be means like more or less to rationally desire it or to produce it through your actions. So so you can't consistently will such a world to be or to exist. Therefore, Kant calls it the contradiction of will. So why would this be? Well, Kant thinks that, let's see if I got something to work here. So everyone needs help sometime. So it would be irrational if you like fell into a pit and somebody came along with a rope and you're trying to climb up the muddy sides and the guy says, here, climb up this rope, and you say, no, I'm going to get out of this pit myself. I'm a rugged individualist. Kant would say, that's irrational. If someone offers help, the rational person will take the help. And everyone needs help sometime. And so what the rugged individualist says is that, well, I'll take help when it's offered to me, when I'm desperate and there's no other way, but all the rest of the time I want to do it, you know, do it myself. And Kant says everybody needs help sometime, and so in order to accept help, you have to be willing to give help. Again, this is universalizability. You have to imagine, you could imagine a world where nobody helped anyone without a reward, but to be a rational person wouldn't want that to be the real world. And so so the rational thing to do would be therefore to offer help when it's needed and to take help when you need it. So what Kant said, and this is where Kant gets positive duties. So you have negative duties, duties not to do certain things, and then you have positive duties to do certain things. So you have a duty to help people in need. Another example, the unambitious person. Suppose you say, well, I don't really want to do anything in life except for get by. And I'm going to perform menial labor for just enough money for beer and marijuana and to rent games at the game store. And Kant would say that, and maybe like watch some movies with the $5 for 5 movies deal. Every Friday or something. So if that's your life, Kant would say that could you imagine a world where everyone did that? Where everyone just did enough to get by? Where no one developed their talents and abilities? And in such a world, would you want such a world to exist? And Kant would say no, because you think about what would your life be in such a world? Yeah.
What about the Amish? Like, they... I wouldn't say, well, some are ambitious.
Crude tools and hard work.
Some are ambitious, but
if everyone lived like that ambitious person, there'd be nobody to make the movies or the video games or grow the weed or brew the beer.
There you go. So it'd be, your life would be miserable. And so Kant says that no one would want a world like that to be. Therefore, you have a duty to develop your talents just like everyone else to produce that world where those talents exist. It's inconsistent for you to say, I'm not going to develop my talents, but I expect everyone else to develop their talents. It's again, he calls that a contradiction in will. I just have a couple of things I need to get through before we finish. Actually, I'll say that for the first part of my last question.
Well, I don't know. Like, couldn't you say that you're just getting by? Like, if you live in an Amish commune and you just do enough to get by. Like,
they get booted out. They get booted out of the Amish commune. Yeah.
I say, first off, yeah, the Amish don't really like unmotivated, lazy people.
Okay.
But secondly, even apart from, brewing the beer, growing the weed, making the movies, making video games, there's no menial job for you to work to do that. That job is essentially somewhere up the chain. Someone developed their talents and made those jobs happen.
Right.
So if everybody were to live that way, then nobody could live that way. Because if everyone were to live on just enough to get by as subsistence, that's not really something that we would be capable of in our current society.
Yep.
True subsistence would be farming your own food, hunting, etc., which takes some effort and therefore ambition.
We're gonna finish Kant on Monday and move on to Aristotle.